Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Hello, today we're talking about why companies decide to issue fixed income securities and the process with George Whittle, Head of Funding at Bright. Welcome, George. How are you?
Hi, Liz. I'm really well. How are you?
I'm well too. Can you tell us a little bit about Bright? It's quite an interesting story.
Yeah, sure. So in many respects, it's not my story to tell, but the business was founded in 2016 by Catherine McConnell, who was coming out of Macquarie and had identified that the types of businesses who install solar panels on people's homes and businesses didn't really have a compelling point of sale finance proposition for the business owners and householders in those various properties. So set up the business. The first loans were actually funded using Kath's own mortgage. And, you know, as we stand today, we've distributed going on $2 billion worth of capital to homeowners generally to fund solar panels to go on the roofs of their houses.
That's such a worthwhile business as we transition to zero emissions. Can you talk a little bit about now Bright's funding mix and, you know, when did Bright first think to invest or to issue fixed income securities and raise funds that way?
Good question. So Kath identified basically from inception that what she needed to work the business towards was a traditional non-bank funding model where you have equity, obviously, but the vast majority of that capital comes from debt capital markets, either in the private format, which is where it comes from when you're scaling up, and then once you're at scale from public markets, through asset-backed securities. So it's really been part of the plan from the get-go, and there have been a variety of iterations of that within the business. We work very closely with NAB, who's our major banking partner, and have one private facility that's essentially a big pool of revolving capital that we can use to fund fund consumers who want to get solar panels and make other sustainable home improvements. And then we have a public asset-backed securities program where we will come to market with roughly a $200 million transaction once a year. That's both a different type of investor with a different kind of, risk-return outlook. But it means we can refinance that private capital and keep moving forwards as we go.
So you've actually issued asset-backed securities into the public market and you did one very recently. Can you just talk a little bit about that structure and how you brought it to market? I mean, typically companies that issue fixed income securities do a roadshow. Did you do a roadshow and talk to investors? Perhaps if you can just talk us through a little bit about the process.
Yeah, sure. So the program is called Bright Green Trust, and in 2020 we did the first transaction, and it was Australia's first wholly green asset-backed securities deal. There had been others previously where they might have had one green bond out of a broader set, and really what you're doing is you have tens of thousands of underlying receivables that sit in a trust. And in order for the trust to fund the purchase of those receivables, you raise a whole lot of capital in debt markets. And you'll have a variety of different notes that are called tranches. And they each receive principal and income derived from the underlying portfolio of receivables. And because some of those notes have higher priority than others, they have higher corresponding credit ratings, and they also have lower interest rates for those higher credit ratings. And so you take this, you have this relatively standard structure that's informed by the portfolio of receivables and also by a set of analysis that the ratings agencies do. You structure a transaction around that, and then you go to market. You called out the roadshow element there. There is a roadshow. We always try to do one. We have a very deep investor base who have been historically very supportive. So this year, as in prior years, we've been pretty well covered before we even have the first meeting in the roadshow. But the roadshow is a really important process, not just for the investors in, you know, the 2023 transaction, but for the investors who might consider participating in the 2024 transaction or the 2025 transaction. It's all about building out that investor base through time, because we don't want to play the game just once.
So it sounds like you issue debt securities every year, is that right? And you have an annual raising, or can you? And that's the intent going forward as well.
Yeah. So it's always informed by financial markets, and in some years it's going to be easier than others. You know, since 2020, we've come every year, and the intention is to keep coming every year, and for those transactions to grow in size over time. And, you know, one day we might end up in a world where we're doing two every year. And in some years, you know, markets might be very challenging and we might skip a year. But the intention is certainly to come every year.
Oh, that's great, George, you've had those issues. Has anything gone not quite as to plan, or has everything gone to plan? Is it typical that there can be a last-minute hitch and you have to slightly change the structure or the pricing?
So the pricing by no means gets baked in on a transaction until the very end. There's always a process of going out with indications that you might have a transaction, and you gauge interest from investors, and then you might think about it best like a soft book build, and so you get a feel for what the demand is going to be like and for what the pricing is going to look like. This year, there weren't a lot of other transactions in market that were comparable to ours. And so getting a feel for pricing was a little more difficult than it might have been. What that meant was we started on the AAA tranche, for example, feeling people out at a margin over BBSW of 1.65% and ended up at 1.55%. So you kind of work with people, and sometimes it goes the other way and you start at a level and move, 5 or 10 basis points wider. Our experience has been historically pretty straightforward. 2022 was a challenging year, as I'm sure your listeners know, for all financial markets. Between the broader geopolitical environment, between what was happening with macroeconomic policy settings, that meant that a lot of investors, especially in the institutional space, had decided, I'm just going to, wait and see what happens and deploy capital later. Fortunately, we have a very supportive investor base, and the product that we're bringing to market is pretty attractive, both because of the ESG aspect, but also the underlying creditworthiness of the people who we are lending money to, who, underpin the transaction. And so that meant that we were able to do a deal in 2022 where other parties in the market might have had to pause their ambitions and wait until 2023. So it's not always easy, and the pricing does move around, but there's always a pathway.
And you just do floating rate securities as well. These notes are floating rate, so that would have been easier, I imagine, to sell in 2022 than a fixed rate bond.
Yeah, yes and no. So the ease of selling a fixed rate note versus a floating rate note is kind of a moot point. The whole market is floating rate. And so the money that we, Bright, lend to customers is all fixed rate. So it would actually be really beneficial for me to be able to fund with fixed rate. unfortunately, the market convention means that floating is what we have to fund with, and so you know, part of my role as well is managing that interest rate risk that arises for the business. We have talked to investors about doing fixed rate historically, but they basically say, you know, there will be a liquidity impact, and so you'll end up paying more as a margin to swap than you might if it's just in a floating format. So, you know, either the cost falls on me via buying interest rate swaps, or the cost falls on me via paying more as a margin. So, you know, it's kind of follow the path of least resistance, I suppose.
Yeah, make it easier for investors. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. We know that well. I know you recently had a successful issue raising $200 million to refinance your debut asset-backed securities. Can you talk a little bit about just in investor appetite over that time? And have you seen more investors come into the transaction? Are there any overseas investors or interest? And maybe just talk a little bit about that.
So this year's transaction that settled in August was in part to refinance that 2020 deal, the original Bright Green Trust. There was only $35 million of that outstanding. These deals amortize over time. So the bulk of the capital and the bulk of the underlying pool of receivables was really deals that we had originated over the course of 2022 and 2023 calendar year to date. So the investor appetite in part was from the investors who had been in that original 2020 transaction. You know, we work really closely with them and keep them up to date on, you know, how that portfolio is performing, but also on the broader business. And they were at a point where, you know, many of them have invested, you know, in 2021 and 2022. So there was some carryover of investors. But the demand piece in this year's transaction was, of course, broader than that. A lot of my role is the investor relations piece, you know, across the senior investors who, you know, make up 80% of the transaction or thereabouts, and then the mezzanine investors who might be more specialist credit funds or family offices and so on. And so that does build out as we go through. You never want to sell the whole transaction to one party, and one party doesn't want to buy it either. They want, you know, the price confidence that they get by having multiple participants in each tranche. The offshore question is a really, you know, interesting part of that, because these securities are not, I suppose, vanilla debt instruments. They're not bonds per se, but rather securitization. And securitization has a whole set of regulations globally, but specific to investors in each jurisdiction as well, that govern what deals have to look like and what data needs to be provided to centralized authorities in order for those to be, you know, investable assets. And so a really great example of this is in the European Union, a fund that is based out of there or is compliant with EU rules needs what's called risk retention. And that, you know, there's a data provision element of that, but then there's also, you know, the risk retention element, where the originator needs to keep 5% of the transaction. For us, the ratings agency derived, you know, seller note, the equity contribution that we have to put into these deals, this year was 2.2%. We've had as low as 1%. And just from a capital intensity perspective, 5% is a lot of the deal. You can find ways to fund that 5% and still be compliant with the requirements, but you have to kind of pay for the legal structures to make all that work. So there are a set of investors who we could certainly tap if we needed to, just by meeting the EU risk retention compliance rules. But at the moment, we've settled for domestic investors and then investors who are based, you know, in Asia broadly. So we've seen folks from, I say folks, but you know, large institutions from Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong.
Excellent. That's really exciting. It's so good to see smaller companies issuing debt securities and using the market and it just growing. I understand some of the tranches were oversubscribed. How do you deal with that? How do you apportion the debt?
Yeah, so it's always tricky. Everyone wants to get bonds. Nobody wants to get scaled. This year we had, I suppose, two approaches that are worth talking about. Because there was, frankly, really significant demand across the mezzanine tranches, so that's everything not rated AAA, we put the mandate out there, which, you know, says you're thinking about bringing a transaction to market. And at that point, there's no pricing information. There's a term sheet and an investor pack. So limited detail, really. But on the back of that, we had enough interest to close off. So remove from marketing all of the mezzanine tranches except for the Class Fs, which are rated single B. And we had enough interest there too. Just that investor was happy to be scaled. So that was to avoid a scenario where I was going to have to, allocate people zero. There's nothing worse from my seat than having to call somebody and say, unfortunately, we'd love to have you participate, but we can't. So we closed it off. And I think from the investor's side too, they appreciate knowing that. It's not worth them doing work on something because they might have to go to investment committee or credit committee. You don't want to waste people's time. So that was the first element of it. And then with the AAA tranche where we were also oversubscribed, the easiest route is always just a pro rata allocation. So just, you know, scaling people in proportion to what they bid into the book. Sometimes you get creative, and sometimes you get on the phone and ask people if they would please be okay with you doing something in a certain way that might otherwise seem unfair. For the most part, you just scale pro rata and people get on with it and move on to the next transaction.
Excellent. Can you talk a little bit about the different tranches and the, returns on those different tranches?
Sure. So, again, what you have is an underlying portfolio of assets, and those assets generate principal and interest and also losses, and those principal and interest collections and the losses get allocated differently between the different classes of notes that you've structured, and you structure each of those classes of notes so that they will have a credit rating outcome. And those credit rating outcomes will range from AAA through to single B in our case. And you can kind of cut them as fine as you like. And you want to do that because different investors have different fund mandates. So they might have a mandate exclusively for BBB and BB rated bonds. And so having something that has a, you know, double A and triple B, you know, thickness is not really attractive for them. So you work through that process to structure the transaction to give different investors the outcomes that they want. And in, you know, there's a fair number of these transactions that are happening all the time. Most of them are residential mortgages, but there's also a lot of asset-backed securities in, you know, autos and unsecured consumer and small business lending. And so you've got different price points at a given point in time, as well as just, of course, the broader kind of corporate bond market that gives investors visibility through to, you know, what they think something should pay. And then you kind of work to pricing outcomes based on that. So in our case, the AAA is priced at 1.55% over 30-day BBSW, and as you move down the structure, they gradually get, you know, more expensive for us or yieldier for investors, I suppose, going all the way down to the Class Fs that were at BBSW plus 8.75%. So by the time you're getting to the bottom of the structure, the reward side becomes quite meaningful for investors, I think.
Excellent. And the weighted average life of the tranche differs too, doesn't it, between the AAA and the F security. So, and you predict that at the start, or the rating agency predicts it at the start. So that's another factor I guess we could talk about, but I think that's probably not so interesting, that sort of an 8% plus return over a 30-day BBSW sounds very attractive. No wonder that mezzanine debt was fully subscribed, oversubscribed. Is there anything about the process that you would like to talk about? I think it's, I mean, I guess there's treasurers sitting out there in, you know, medium-sized businesses that haven't, or maybe have thought about it but thought it was too scary. Perhaps maybe, you know, in you talked about your main banking relationship and how they've worked with you. Is that the sort of first port of call for a treasurer or a head of funding thinking about entering the market, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think difficult for me to speak about the broader kind of corporate world, but certainly in non-bank lending land, you will have a primary bank, and that primary bank will almost certainly want to help you on the broader kind of capital solutions journey, and they may even have rights in that respect. So remove that choice from you. But they're also the ones who have you know, deep relationships with a whole lot of investors, both domestically and internationally. They know who can write a $1 million ticket in the single B rated tranche, and they know who can write you a $200 million ticket in the AAA rated tranche. So working with them is certainly the first port of call. But, you know, raising capital is not about the, you know, 3-day roadshow you might do. It's about the 12 months that you lead into the transaction. And ultimately, those investors, while the bank might talk to them initially on your behalf, and while, you know, the bank might deal with them, you know, continuously on a whole lot of transactions, they're your relationships. They're yours to build and grow. And ultimately, it's just a matter of getting in touch with people and telling them about your program and your business. If it's compelling, which it will be, then you can work with them on that and get them advanced on their investment committee or credit committee process, like, well ahead of time, because no one likes to rush.
It's a very good tip. Is there anything you want to add about the Australian securitisation market in general, or any observations you might have since you've been working in the area?
Sure. So the Australian securitisation market is really dominated by residential mortgage-backed securities. They're a very well-established asset class. It's a huge part of the Australian debt capital markets landscape. And lots and lots of investors have, you know, big mandates for that kind of paper. Asset-backed securities are really well established in autos, for example. The collateral is really well understood, and the deals are really well received. The parts that are really developing still are in the unsecured consumer space, ex credit cards. Credit cards are a really well established product. But buy now, pay later, unsecured consumer, which is in general for stuff like debt consolidation or travel or weddings or so on, and small business lending, all of these types of collateral have been, you know, building up over time, but still are much, much, much smaller than the mortgage space. So, you know, an interesting thing that occurred last year as part of the broader set of macro concerns was there were a whole lot of UK domiciled pension funds that had invested very significantly in Australian dollar securitizations. And the received wisdom was that these would be, you know, illiquid deals in a downside scenario. Now, those pension funds faced a situation where they basically had to sell a whole lot of assets and raise a whole lot of liquidity in short order. And the things that they could sell in short order were actually their Aussie dollar securitization exposures. They turned out to be liquid. They turned out to be very price stable. And that has been, I think, a real turning point in the broader investor understanding of the kinds of securities that, you know, we as an industry are generating for investors at an institutional and sub-institutional level. It's, you know, I think really, really opened people's eyes to the space and the relative value.
Excellent, George. I think what Bright's doing is very exciting, and I'm watching and looking, and would say to people if they're thinking about solar to have a look at your website and, you know, think about the funding issue if you need some extra funds. But also I was going to ask you, do you think there's ever any scope in future to have some sort of retail investment product for retail investors or like mum and dad investors into investing into something like Bright or some of the securitization programs?
That's a good question, Liz. I think it's, you know, because what we're issuing is not really homogenous year on year, I think it will always be a relatively complex investment for an individual. And, you know, there are, I would feel comfortable personally investing in it, but I feel like I have, you know, domain expertise. You know, would I tell my mum to do it? Probably not, because she doesn't have the same domain expertise. I think where exposures to companies like Bright or non-bank lenders in more general become interesting on the debt side is really when you're at larger scale and you can do a more traditional corporate bond format in, say, a four-year floating rate note. And there are some of the larger, you know, mortgage originators who have issued those kinds of bonds, and I think they've been pretty well received. Those, I think, are something that, you know, very well understood. I'd make the carve out on all of this that in the residential mortgage-backed securities space in particular, the structures naturally de-lever over time, and the ratings agencies are very conservative. And so you get paid quite well for the actual risk that you are taking on day zero. And if an Australian investor is well placed to understand, frankly, really anything, it's Australian residential property. And so where that is a pool of collateral, I think there's really a place. But, you know, how many Australian investors want to buy AAA rated notes at 100 over? I'm just, you know, I think
not many, George.
I think people have more risk appetite than that. So that's the challenge as well.
That's excellent, George. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to have you and your insights. All the best to Bright for the future, and we'll enjoy watching you grow, the company grow, and get more solar into homes and to issue more debt securities in coming years.
Thanks, Liz. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran, and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.